From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you've ever been to a beach house or a rec center or spent rainy afternoons at your grandma's, then you probably know Scrabble. You know, the board game where you try to rack up the points by forming words from a jumble of letter tiles. Is your love of the game something you tell people on a first date? Probably not, as depicted in the 2001 film The Wedding Planner. Here, Mary, played by Jennifer Lopez, fesses up to her love interest Steve, played by Matthew McConaughey. Can you spell loser?
A Scrabble practice.
Please, don't ask.
Oh, no, come on. Can't leave me hanging on that. I'll see you at Scrabble practice, kid. What is that?
I'm a member of the Bay Area Scrabble Club. Pathetic, I know.
Wow.
What?
That is pathetic.
Shut up. At least I can spell. What can you do?
I throw a mean yo-yo.
But there is another side of the game. Cutthroat, competitive, obsessive, elite, beloved. Players memorize tens of thousands of words, two-letter words, words with Q's that don't have U's, and compete on the world stage. That's the world John D. Williams Jr. presided over for more than two decades as the executive director of the National Scrabble Association. He tells all in his new book, Word Nerd. This hour, On Point, we go deep into the world of Scrabble. You can join us on air or online. How did you discover the game? If you are an adult, do you still play? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining us now from New York is John D. Williams Jr. As the executive director of the National Scrabble Association, he served as the official spokesperson for the game. His previous book, a bestseller, is Everything Scrabble. He co-authored that one. His latest is Word Nerd, Dispatches from the Games, Grammar, and Geek Underground. And John D. Williams, Jr., welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
You know what surprised me from reading the book? I assumed, before I read the book, that you became the president of the association because you were obsessed with the game. But actually, it was the other way around. I mean, you played, but you became obsessed because you were the association president, that you actually didn't play all that much before, correct?
I didn't. I came from a family of word lovers and grammar freaks and all that stuff. And we were gamers, but it was more about cards and trivia, and really didn't play that much Scrabble until a crazy set of circumstances found me in this job. And then I knew right away that I had to become, in order to have credibility with the players and the press and everybody else, that I need to become a tournament player, which I did. Once I started, I was hooked.
You got hooked. Yeah. Did you realize before you started this job that people were as passionate about Scrabble as they are?
I was familiar with subcultures in general, and I knew it was kind of out there, but I had no idea whatsoever of the depth of this in some people's lives, to the point it was part of their self-identity.
You know, it's funny. I'm just going to mention this because obviously people can't see this at the moment. You in the book, you always write Scrabble with all capitals, and I assume that's because it's a trademark name.
Legal stuff. Yeah.
Legal stuff. Right. Okay. But that was interesting to me because people think it's a game that's always just kind of been around. It's always been there, but it's not. I mean, somebody had to invent it. And you say in the book that it wasn't a hit at first. You print a lot of rejection letters about when the inventor of the game first started to get it going. Can you tell us just a little bit about the early history of it?
Sure. The inventor was a guy named Alfred Mosher Butts, and he was an out-of-work architect back in the Depression. And he thought he would try to make – so there was no building going on, really. So he was trying to make some extra money, and he thought, well, I'll try inventing a game. And he'd always loved anagrams, and he'd always loved crossword puzzles and whatever. And being an architect, he loved, you know, the grid kind of thing. So he spent about almost a decade tinkering around with it. It was called at one point Lexico. Another time it was called Crisscross Words. And eventually he finally got it right and then tried to shop it. And yeah, I have two rejection letters from the mid-1930s. One from Parker Brothers, one from Milton Bradley, the two biggest companies, both saying effectively, you know, Mr. Butts, thanks for your cute little idea, but we don't really see any mass potential in this game. And it's now 100 million games later.
Oops. One of those oops.
Exactly.
What made it take off?
Well, just the inherent appeal of the game, of course, would, sooner or later was going to make that happen. But the story was that in 1952, the president of Macy's in New York was on vacation in Bermuda, I believe, and someone had a Scrabble game, and everybody, they just couldn't stop playing the whole time. He'd never seen it or heard of it, and kind of chased it down, and Macy's did a little promotion, and it just kind of got traction. And although going viral didn't exist in those days, that's pretty much what happened with it.
Do you find that people become obsessive about it, even if they're not tournament players? We're going to get to the tournament play in a second, but do you find that people get obsessed over it?
Yes, there are. It's you know, not unlike people that they can't start their day without doing the Times crossword puzzle or trivia nuts. Yeah, they're people that, as I said earlier, it's a big part of their life. They don't go a day without playing Scrabble, which I'm guilty of myself. But
Did you play today already?
Not yet.
But you're going to play.
I will.
You're just not going to feel right if you don't play.
Yeah, I played a match last night, an outdoor match in front of against a former national champion. So I'm still recovering from that experience.
You know, to that end, though, I just have a short clip on this. There was a documentary in 2004 called Word Wars that talks a little bit about this, and I just want to play a short clip from that. Here's a recreational Scrabble player named Lynn Cushman who plays. You just mentioned you played outdoors. She plays in Washington Square Park in New York City, and she and her friend were interviewed for this documentary, and she talked about this. Here it is.
A lot of doing well at this game is the obsession. I mean, you really do have to have the brain working and knowing how to assess the probabilities and
spend
things.
Hours and hours studying and memorizing
But without
words.
That obsession, you're just not going to get that far.
So how does that – how do you cross over into tournament? How does that happen? I know you did it for professional reasons because you had to have cred, right?
Right.
With your peeps.
Exactly.
But what about other people? How do they get into that world?
Well, first I have to say that in the Scrabble world, to describe Lynn Cushman as a recreational player would be selling her short. She's the top-rated woman in New York, I know, and one of the top-rated players in the country. So
I duly noted. Sorry for that.
I don't want you or I to get in trouble for that.
I hear you. Thank you for that.
Well, it's part of the passion they have. Essentially what happens is people hear about tournament Scrabble. And they chased either down the National Scrabble Association or the current governing body, which is called North American Scrabble Players Association. And they try to entice them to come to a Scrabble club. There are hundreds of local Scrabble clubs, and they teach them some of the fundamentals of strategy. And they learn what we call the cheat sheet, which is critical words to know, and some of the real simple things about don't be afraid to pass and just strategic stuff. And probably around one in every 10 of those people go on to become part of the Scrabble culture and the tournament scene, and the others are scared off. And they go home and are happy to beat all their friends and family. But it's not pretty.
Well, you know, everybody who likes something a lot generally thinks that it offers life lessons, right? But you and other players really think that Scrabble does. I mean, to that end, I want to play another clip from Marlon Hill, who, I will not make that mistake again, is a competitive Scrabble player.
Yes,
and he was also profiled in the documentary Word Wars. And he grew up in Baltimore. He went to Ralph Budge Elementary School in Carson, California, to teach students how to play Scrabble. And this is what he says about why he thinks it's relevant. Let's see if you agree. Here it is. Mm-hmm.
Scrabble is a game where it helps you in a lot of ways. It mirrors life in a lot of ways. You have seven letters that you have to make a decision with, and that basically is life. No matter what kind of thing happened to you in your life, just do the best you can do in the circumstance you find yourself in.
So you think that's true? I think what he's saying is it's a combination of both skill and luck. Things are all skill, and like you got to be 7 feet tall, and you got to be tall and fast. Mm-hmm. Whatever. Some things are all skill, some things are all luck. This is a combination of both. Do you think that's true?
I do, absolutely. It's a game just like cards, for example, is also similar. It's just a classic metaphor for life, and I'm a big believer in the okay. Here's the hand I'm dealt today. How am I going to play it? You know, some of these things, some of these tiles I don't want, some I do. And, you know, and that applies, you can extrapolate that into pretty much any, and use it as an approach to almost anything, I think.
What separates the good from the great?
A bunch of things. At a certain level, at the very top, it's a given you have most or all of the dictionary memorized. So And then you get into, and then you have to know all the subtleties of strategy. You have to, board vision is a big term we use. For example, where's the best play? You're combing over the board and seeing, okay, what's the most opportunistic play for me? That's always important. And also understanding that a good Scrabble move is not for the most points always. It's what you score with and what you leave on your rack to work with. For example, if I make a great play and I leave W, U, and V on my rack, my rack's going to stink for the next three or four turns, you know, because those are just very unworkable tiles. And then there's also the spiritual and mental psychological component is huge, huge. I've seen a lot of people that have all the tools, but they don't have the maturity. They don't understand that you leave it in the move. You know, you try to stay in the actual move. You know, here are the tiles. Here's my situation. Keep it there. And at best, stay in the game. Don't think about, oh, I lost that last game. I got killed. Oh, I'm playing a national champion in the next game. And a lot of people just – the intensity of it overtakes a lot of people. And just can't quite turn that corner to put it all together.
How can you tell that that's how come people fall apart? Do they tell you that afterwards? They say, oh, I was thinking about blah, 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 and that's how come I fell apart.
Over time, their performance shows it.
Okay.
Basically,
this guy knows
every word, but for some reason he fades in the beginning of tournaments or in the end of tournaments. That kind of, there's all kinds of subtleties.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Scrabble, the world's most popular word game. You can join the conversation. What's your favorite Scrabble word or play? In other words, what's your secret weapon? Do you agree that Scrabble has taught you things you didn't learn somewhere else? And if so, what? With us from New York is John D. Williams, Jr. For more than two decades, he served as executive director of the National Scrabble Association. He's the co-author of Everything Scrabble. His new book is Word Nerd, Dispatches from the Games, Grammar, and Geek Underground. And we have a question for you from Veronica, who is calling from New Orleans. Veronica, what's your question?
Hi, Michelle. So my question is about the strategy of the game. I've actually never been able to beat my fiance, Kevin, in Scrabble. We have very different ways of playing. I try for the most interesting words or the words that are sort of, you know, with all the various letters that I have on my block, whereas he just goes for what is going to get him the most points and tends to win with two- or three-letter words. So I'm just curious if that really is kind of the only way to win is to play like that.
The short answer, Veronica, is yes. You're not going to win unless you score the most points using the most letters. You're playing along the artistic, creative side where, and this does happen. You can't help yourself but make that beautiful play that just slides in between a couple of others or is a obscure word that you dug out of somewhere. But the reality is it's about scoring a lot of points. And unless you know the ways to do that, you're not going to win too many games.
Well, you know, John, why don't we just go right there? Since you All talk right. about this in the book, you say this is one of the things that you're constantly asked about, which is why so many of the champions are men, given that, you know, from a very early age, women, girls tend to test better on the verbal skills. And yet, you know, in the book, I mean, this was as of January of 2015, the top 10 champions that you listed were all men. What is up with that?
I know. As a father of two daughters and someone who grew up in a house full of women, this is something that strikes home to me. It's mystifying at first to people that don't understand that Scrabble at its core is more about math than it is about language or words. Games are simply poker chips or, game pieces at the highest level, or the tiles are, rather. And it's a given that everybody knows, again, at the top level, pretty much the whole dictionary. So then it becomes about, probability. There are 12 E's in the game, and, five have been played. I have two. Maybe my opponent has some. How many are left in the rack? So that gets into more on the math side of the learning tree, probability, calculating things. And if I score in this place, I'll get 66 points. If I go here, I'll get 73, but I'll open up a spot for him. And so it's really more about the logic, math side of the brain at that top level than it is about the language, word, communication, which is one explanation for why. It will change over time, I have no doubt whatsoever, and as well it should.
Let's get another perspective on this, shall we?
Yes.
And we have, joining us from Toronto, Robin Pollack-Daniel. She is one of the top-ranked players in the world. She's certainly one of the top-ranked female players, but she's been ranked as high as number 3 in North America. She's been competing in tournaments for more than 30 years. Robin Pollack-Daniel, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us as well.
Hi, Michelle. A pleasure.
So how did you get bitten by the Scrabble bug?
Well, I used to play games with my mother, certainly when I was a young child, before a dictionary and before a time clock, so that was pretty difficult. But I actually had a stint in the hospital, and my roommate had a game, and she drug out a board, and she played the word zarf. And I just found that fascinating. And I was hooked.
Okay. And so, but when did you realize you were great at it?
Well, I was very lucky in that I grew up, so to speak, in the Montreal Scrabble Club, and I got to play two eventual world champions. And the rule in Scrabble is always to play somebody a little better than you, if not a lot better than you. So I got to practice with them a lot. And as John writes in his book, I did go up about 200 points in one tournament. And I went from intermediate to expert in one fell swoop. And at that point, I realized I was okay. But the only time I really realized I was good was when I really started to sit down and study all the words. Because you could have all the natural talent you want, but if you don't know the words. And then the opposite is true, too. You can know all the words, but you can have no talent. So when I was able to combine the two in a reasonable 50-50, I knew I was pretty good.
Well, what do you make of John's theory? John's theory is that this game kind of favors the math brain, as it were. It's really more about math and strategy than it is about words and verbal ability itself. He also has some other theories in the book about just the competitiveness or the emphasis or the willingness to kind of really slam it down and go for the jugular. And, what do you think about that?
Well, yeah, there's no question that women are socialized differently than men. We are not encouraged to be as competitive. We're more nurturing. We want to take care of people. You know, even when I was, I was pregnant with my kids or I had young babies, I would be ferocious with my words as I was with my children. Like, this is my study time. Now, how many women give themselves permission to do that? How many women, say, allow themselves to watch sports or compete in sports competitively? We're just not conditioned that way. So I think that's a big part of it. And I think another part of it is that we just don't get paid for our efforts, and therefore it's not given legitimacy. So it's one thing for a man who has a job out there and he's making good money, and then he also has this crazy hobby on the side. But a lot of us either our mothers and chosen to stay home to be with our kids, and then we do this thing which takes up an inordinate amount of time, which most of us don't allow ourselves to do, and then we don't even get paid for it. So I think if I started getting paid along the lines of Serena Williams, I would suddenly go up in the estimation of a lot more people.
Interesting. John, what do you think about that? That's interesting. What do you make of her analysis?
Right, it's right on the money, and she's, you couldn't have anyone better than Robin, so... it's true. The best thing I've heard was a Sports Illustrated writer who told me, forget all your stupid theories about testing and brains and all this. He said, women aren't that nuts. You know, it's men who sit around and, memorize baseball statistics and the difference of a fin on a 1957 Cadillac versus a DeSoto. And it's kind of, women are just too busy with the business of life for that. So, and I should mention too, your phones or whatever going to ring. What's the word zarf that Robin just mentioned? And that is the aluminum or plastic thing on your dashboard that holds a coffee cup. That's what zarf is. Yes.
Well, I know it more as the Russian, the intricate thing that holds the glass for your tea from Russia, the intricate metal. Yeah. So that's how I found it interesting.
Let's take a call. This is Judy is calling from Reading, Massachusetts. Judy loves the game, too. Judy?
Hi.
Yeah.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Judy.
And John. John, this is Judy Horn. How are you?
Judy, how are you doing? Judy is a well-known Scrabble promoter.
Oh, okay.
In the Boston area, known to both Robin and myself, of course.
Okay.
So. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hi, Judy.
So I would just like to say that back when I was dating, if I said I was interested in Scrabble and got that reaction, there certainly wouldn't be any more dates. And as it happens, I met my husband at a Scrabble tournament, and we're coming up on our 20th anniversary.
Well, congratulations. So if Matthew McConaughey turned up and just said, I don't play Scrabble, it'd be like later for you.
Well, Matthew McConaughey, I guess I'd have to think about that one.
Okay. Thank you, Judy. Julie, what about you? Julie's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Julie, what do you have to say about it?
Hi. I was wondering if there were any studies done on whether playing Scrabble regularly held off the decline of the mind and made people sharper and smarter and helped with memory and those types of things. My mother and her partner are both in their 80s, and they play every day. They're voracious Scrabble players. I could never even compete with them. But they're very competitive about it, and they're both two of the smartest people I know. So I'm just wondering if there is any, maybe any connection there or any studies that have been done.
That's interesting, John. Are there?
Yeah, well, it's been pretty well documented in the last decade or so that this kind of thing, whether it's Scrabble or chess or something similar, can definitely keep your brain sharp, and it's like it's exercise for the brain. You know, it's that simple. We've had about three or four times where teams of sociologists or psychologists and graduate students came to national Scrabble championships and actually studied, interviewed the players, and pretty much came to that conclusion.
John, do you know of a single person? I've been in Scrabble for 30 years. I don't know of a single case in all those years of a player coming down with Alzheimer's. Do you?
You know what? You're right, Robin. No one comes to mind.
Yeah.
No one comes to mind.
Robin, before we let you go, what was your favorite play?
Oh.
Hopefully it's not a word. It doesn't involve a word that's
not
been banned.
You know this.
Oh, my first word. I'm not going to say that one. I once made a very obscure word, popliteae. You know, when people ask us our favorite word, it's very, very difficult because sometimes it's just a simple three-letter word that wins you a tournament. But certainly ones that come to mind are ones that scored over 200 points, like flathead and an azotize through a Z after just bingoing with the Yiddish word schmaltz. So I think that sequence were two of my favorite.
Okay, that was your sequence, your favorite play. Yeah, there were, John, oh, Robin, I'm going to let you go now. Thank you, Robin Pollack-Daniel,
sure.
One of the top
Bye,
ranked. She's been ranked as high as number three in North America, been competing, as she told us, for more than 30 years. Robin, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks.
You know, John, you point out in the book, and we're going to talk a little bit more of this even after we take our break, if we have time, that any sport or activity that rewards obsessiveness is going to attract, how should we say, some eccentric characters. Can you just tell us, we might have to do a little bit of editing for reasons of taste, some of your favorite characters from the world of competitive Scrabble?
Well, I coined the phrase highly individualized people, which I felt was a little sweeter to say. Yeah, there's people there. You know, that one guy I knew had Scrabble pajamas, Scrabble draperies, Scrabble coffee cup. His whole apartment was decorated completely like a Scrabble, almost like Silence of the Lambs. You know, like this little warren that he lived in, and it was just completely devoted to Scrabble. There's a guy named Joel Sherman, G.I. Joel. But the GI stands for gastrointestinal, and he has a very nervous stomach. He gets pretty wound up when he plays, so he's always got a jug of Maalox on the table right next to him, swigs it all day long. We have Joe Edley, a three-time national champion who will do Tai Chi right in the middle of the floor with 700 people around him in a complete trance as a way of getting himself into the right head for his next match. The list goes on.
You talk about in the book, though, you talk about the fact that people take this very seriously. So seriously, in fact, that you know of at least one case where a guy stabbed a guy over an argument, during an argument over Scrabble rules.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Was a prison. That was actually a prison game.
Okay.
The single largest group that we corresponded with at the Scrabble Association when that was actually guys in prison. And we would get letters all the time, requests for stuff all the time. And this guy got in an argument with another inmate, and it got physical. He stabbed him with a pen, and he wrote to us saying essentially he included the incident report from the warden's office, and he said, "If only I had had a Scrabble dictionary, we could have settled this in a more peaceful manner." So, of course, it was a pitch for a Scrabble dictionary, which we did send him.
You did send him one.
We did send him one.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
But you actually, and you write about this just in the opening couple of pages of the book, that you actually got a really nasty letter over the move to cleanse the Scrabble dictionary, shall we say, of words that people felt were offensive. Well, they are offensive. I mean, but this wasn't even your idea, but you were blamed for this.
And
this is a letter that had to be turned over to the FBI.
And so forth.
So let's talk about that. We only have a couple of minutes left in this segment. We'll come back to it later if we need to.
Okay.
But that is one of the most sort of controversial issues that exists of whether certain words should be allowed. So could you just briefly tell us, how did it happen that there was this move to ban these offensive words?
What happened was two women were playing this is under the category you couldn't make this stuff up. Two women were playing Scrabble in suburban Washington, I believe, and they came across the word Jew used as a verb, and were appalled to even find it in there. And one of the women was a Holocaust survivor, which upped the whole ante. Anyway, so they proceeded to go through the official Scrabble Players Dictionary and found, dozens and dozens of words against everybody, not just against Jews, but, any ethnic, religious, whatever. So they wrote to the game's manufacturer complaining, and they got the runaround. And then they went to the Anti-Defamation League, who took up the cause, and they went back to the manufacturer, who decided to we should take about 175 offensive words. But players call them alleged offensive words because in Scrabble, meanings are meaningless. We don't even have any emotional attachment or history to a word. It's just a chip. So
I can't even say some of these words just because I can't say them. But some of the words that were asked to be cleansed, that were in fact removed from the official Scrabble Players Dictionary, were Bubba. That's one that I can say. Bubba. I'm trying to find one other that
my
I
favorite was. My favorite was Papist or Jesuit.
Jesuit. But that has an alternate meaning.
It does.
That's just descriptive.
Yeah, it was an anti. It was what someone who wasn't in the Anglican Church was called. In England at some point, and it was. Yeah, it was a slur. And,
I'm looking at three pages of words. Unfortunately, I can't think of any others that I can share with you.
But
what's your take on that?
Michelle.
Right, exactly. Yeah. What's your one of them is a bodily function, but I'm just not going to say that either. But but just briefly, what's your take on this? You don't like the idea of taking the words out, even if they are offensive.
At the end of the day, I'm an anti-censorship person, and I hated being in that position. So we can talk more about that.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We are talking about the past, the culture, and the future of Scrabble, the board game, the most popular board game in the world, as it happens. John D. Williams Jr. is our guest. He's the author of the co-author of Everything Scrabble, and now Word Nerd, Dispatches from the Games, the Grammar, and the Geek Underground. And we were talking earlier about how intense these competitions can get. I just want to play just a little bit of sound from a tournament here. This is when the top-ranked Scrabble player in the world, Nigel Rogers, was facing off in 2013 against a challenger in the final match of the World Scrabble Championship. And the match got off to an exciting start. And you're going to hear here the commentators, Jesse Matthews, Chris May, and Mark Nyman, react.
Wow. Come on, have gazumped.
Oh.
This is
what
great
a start for Come On. A huge bingo.
Doesn't need to think about there. This. Just straight down. And play it.
But look at what Nigel has drawn.
Nigel has bejeweled. Wow.
And
this is going to be a huge game already.
See, I thought there was both kind of artistry and competitiveness there. Bejeweled. I'd be excited if I got that on my board. John.
Yeah, well, Nigel Richards is almost certainly the greatest player who's ever lived. He's got a completely photographic memory, and he's just astonishing. He's almost like an android or something like that. So, bejeweled is a nice word, but to him, it's just almost automatic and just another arrow in his arsenal. So,
do you worry about the future of the game?
I worry about the future of the board game. Yeah, as you know, as a culture or civilization, we become increasingly depersonalized, and the idea of a couple of people sitting across a board for an hour, 2 hours, or whatever becomes, I think, endangered. So yeah,
but you can play
about the board game.
But you don't like the internet. You don't like the internet versions, or you don't like the
I do.
Online
I do. It's very different. It's it's a little more mechanical. It's fun. It's great. And I play about 12 people every day, at different times. But so there's always someone to play of your level or a friend. So that part is good. But what you get interpersonally and the human connection and the tactile aspect and just all that stuff. For me, I'm concerned that that's going to go away.
Well, I have a call that might cheer your heart. Here's Knox,
right,
who's calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Knox.
Hi, Michelle.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Better now that I'm talking to you. So how old are you, Knox?
10.
10. And you're playing, right? You competed in the National School Scrabble Tournament, correct?
Yes.
Can I put you on the spot? How'd you do?
Third.
Third? Not bad, not bad. How'd you pick up the game?
My dad is a competitive player, so he taught me it.
He taught it to you? How do you like it, or what do you like about it?
I just like playing it for fun. I just think it's really, really fun.
What about your friends? Do you have to persuade them to play with you? Or is it pretty easy to get a game going?
I have one friend who will play with me, but others don't really play.
Why do you think that is?
Partly because they probably don't like it, and I know that I'm going to beat them. So.
well, they're probably right about that. Kind of, I'm with you on that. Well, Knox, if you're up our way, we'd love to challenge you to a game, and I'm sure Mr. Williams would love to play with you too. Anytime.
Congratulations, yeah. Knox.
One more thing. Mr. Williams is a little concerned about the future of the game. He's worried that not enough kids are picking it up, and what do you think about that? Does that concern you too?
Kind of. I think not many people at my school play. Only one person, only my partner actually plays, and that's it. There are some kids who just do it for fun, but they don't really play competitively.
Okay. Well, good luck, Knox. Thanks for calling us.
Thank you.
Bye, Knox.
Yeah. So I don't know. You make a point. I mean, you talk about a lot of this in your book. In fact, you talk about how this is actually the sweet spot, like age 10 to 12, middle school is actually the sweet spot because younger kids are a little too fidgety and then older kids don't think it's cool. What do you need? Let's see. I think you need maybe... I'm trying to think. Let's think of a strategy here.
Well, most marketers would say you need a celebrity. You need Lady Gaga to tell everyone that she loves to play Scrabble.
Or Rihanna.
Or Kanye West. Yeah, something like that.
Kanye and Kim playing Scrabble. See if you can make that happen.
There's only $1K in the book in the bag, though, so that'd be on. Those egos are too big, I'm afraid.
Well, speaking of that, though, you know, there are a lot of questions about... the words that and the values that how the words are valued and so forth like that. Let me just take another call from Barnett, Vermont about that. Jay's calling. Jay, you had a question.
Yeah, I was wondering why we still value Z's and Q's at 10 when there are two-letter alternatives for those words and you can play Q's without U's and those kinds of things. It seems like the scoring ought to be a little more refined all along the line.
I don't know, John.
This has come up in the last couple of years as with the introduction of the word ZA and QI, especially, and a couple others that maybe that their uniqueness has been somewhat devalued. I think it takes more than just two of these words to really completely rethink everything. There has been a study about it. I don't really know what it concluded. I can only say that... in terms of their probability of appearance in everyday language and in literature and even still on a Scrabble board, they're still pretty unique.
Thanks for the call. John, tell us, how do we talked a little bit about the bad words, taking the bad words out, but how do words get in? Things like, I'm thinking email.
Right.
Can I say twerking? Can I say that word?
Yes, you
twerking?
Can.
Is twerking in there?
I think twerking, just came in,
Just came in.
I believe so,
No need to demonstrate. It's okay.
Good thing it's radio. What happens is at dictionaries, at the end of the day, the words and the dictionaries and everything is just a reflection of the culture and the language. So what happens is words arise, whether it's from the hip-hop culture or from technology or, you know, some other medicine, whatever. Words suddenly appear faintly on the landscape. And once they do, they're tracked by people who are called citation editors at dictionary companies. So they, if you go to a place like Merriam-Webster, they'll have a file of thousands of, like when the word za came in, meaning slang for pizza, I had a lot of people that were just, couldn't believe it was a word, couldn't believe it was acceptable. I went up to Merriam-Webster, and they had at the time they had a file box that was about 3 feet long, filled with index cards. Each one saying, "Oh, the word za was used in this newspaper on this date. The word za was said in a speech by the president of Purdue in at the commencement address." On and on and on. So they essentially track these new words till they get a certain amount of either combination of a frequency and gravity, and then they become eligible, essentially voted on. To be added into the dictionary.
Do you think that the rate of adoption of new words has accelerated in part because of the internet?
Huge. And typically, it took up to 20 years for a word to find its way, like za, for example, or to find its way into a dictionary and subsequently into Scrabble. But now, because of social media, words are now getting in after 3 or 4 years.
We've gotten some communications from listeners on this on Facebook and Twitter. Here's a comment on our website. John says, "I don't approve of some of the new words that were allowed." He doesn't say why.
Believe me, that was essentially part of my job.
That was your life.
There's a part in the book. I would get someone in my office would buzz me. Word complaint. Well, they'd say word. They would say word question on line three. What they really meant was word complaint on line three. And people can't believe some of these things are words. But the reality is, that language is a growing, living thing. And, you know, the we're not saying thou and thy and all that stuff anymore. We're twerking instead. So it's just the way it works.
You do have a funny story in the book about one of the words that we mentioned that I cannot say and how it actually did emerge in a championship game. And then you had a practice of booking the winner on one of the national morning programs.
Right.
The word, as it happens, was a racial slur.
Yes.
I would interpret it as a racial slur. I hope
yes,
you would, too.
It was. And it was designated as such.
And, but it was still allowed in competition at that point?
It still is. I should make something clear that all words are still allowed in a competitive Scrabble and tournament situation. There are no words that have been removed from that at all.
How come? So I don't understand how it works then. What's the force of the...
Because, Michelle, we're trained word professionals. And we know how to disassociate our emotions from a word. And I can't tell you how many times I've sat across from someone who's Jewish or an African-American or someone who's Asian, and one or the other of us has played one of those banned words, often applying to them, themselves. And we just look at each other and shrug, hey, it's the best play. But just a word.
There
and
it
move
is.
On.
Yeah, so the bad words are allowed in competition, but in
yes,
your living
are.
Room, you can disallow them. You can ban them in... In the rec
right.
room, the rec
it's
center.
It's the bookstore, the official Scrabble Players dictionary that you buy in the bookstore does not have those words. That's what it is.
Okay.
All right.
So here's another call. Let's take a call from Clarksville, Tennessee. Quincy is calling. Quincy has a question or a comment. Quincy, what do you think?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Earlier, there was a comment about the internet kind of killing tabletop gaming, or at least, you know, putting a damper on that. And I actually disagree. I think it's the opposite. I don't play a lot of Scrabble, but if it wasn't for the internet, I wouldn't have learned about other wonderful word games like Dexicon or Bananagrams, or, you know, been able to talk to other people online that enjoy board games as much as I do. So I feel like we're in a really great age for board games because we can find, you know, word nerds out there in our communities that we want to play with. And earlier, it was just limited to your family unit, I felt like.
Thanks, Quincy. What about that? John, what about that? I mean, that's
Quincy,
the thing about the internet is it kind of allows you to extend your universe.
It does. But what I was saying earlier is that the tactile and the interpersonal aspect of it was removed by not being on the board game. I get what Quincy's saying, and I agree. You know, that there's so many more games out there, in the future, most gamers will play a game and never even be on a board. So there's plenty of opportunity, but again, the interpersonal, social, connective experience that you have with your family, with a best friend, you know, trash talking, all that kind of stuff. You can do it in a chat box on your computer, but to me, it's still not the same. I love both. I do both, but I still worry about the future of the actual board game with people in person.
I do have to ask you, Quincy, thanks for that question, is that your story is bittersweet because mm-hmm. you had a great run as executive director of the National Scrabble Association, which is a job that I'm sure when you were growing up, you never in a million years thought that existed, let alone
right.
that you would have. But your job has essentially gone away. Why is that? How is all this managed now?
Well, my job is the manufacturer of the game, who ultimately, controls it legally and to some degree financially, whatever, decided to go in a different direction. And the signs were there, and I knew it was time to move on. There's still a Scrabble Association. There are still two co-presidents of it, but it's largely volunteer. We had a staff. We were funded. We had about 8 or 9 people in addition to some freelancers and whatever. But that support kind of disappeared. So it was time to go.
What do you do now?
Well, when I finish the book, I have two screenplays that I'm developing. I've sold a couple of screenplays and done a couple of TV shows and a word-based game show I'm developing. What a surprise that is.
Okay, reality show.
Doing that.
Reality show sounds good.
Exactly.
Please just don't stab anybody for ratings. We don't want that. We don't want to see that.
It won't happen.
We don't have time to take her call, but I did want to forward a question from a listener who wants to know how to encourage kids to play. Do you have any advice for teaching kids how to play?
The first thing I should say that the founding of this National School Scrabble program was probably the most meaningful thing I ever did, because I did get a million kids, not me personally, but our staff, in 20,000 schools to actually play Scrabble in the classroom. So that was really fantastic. But the best way to play with kids is make the game easy. You know, reward them for, you know, don't overwhelm them. You play simple words, they play simple words. Show them how, if you move a word from place to place on the board, it has different value, that kind of thing. Really the way you would introduce a kid to anything is keep a limit on the accomplishments early on and you know, just kind of build on it from there.
Do you let them win? Did you let your kids win when they were little? Did you let them beat you, John?
I would pay my daughter to anagram words. Yes. And I would give my daughter the Daily Jumble, the newspaper. I said, I'll give you a dollar for every word you can do. So.
Bribes, they always work.
Exactly.
John D. Williams Jr. is author of the new book, Word Nerd, Dispatches from the Games, Grammar, and Geek Underground. John D. Williams Jr., thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much. It was great, Michelle.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, pack your sleeping bag, leave that iPhone at home. We're heading off to summer camp, our midsummer salute to an American tradition. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.